Today, where conservatives and liberals disagree to agree, part the last.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
If you haven't caught the first couple of episodes of this discussion, I would encourage you to do so. You can find them on our website, barrycreamer.com, where you also find devotionals and things like that. Or, obviously, you can listen to the previous episodes the same place you found this one. So we would love for you to be able to do that, just so the whole conversation makes maybe a little more sense. I hope it makes a little more sense. We've been talking about how opposites actually do agree. That in our, and not just coincidentally, not, hey, we happen to have more in common than we think, not the casual sense of it, but that the reason we're able to come to blows, to come to the disagreements we have, is actually because we're sharing the same field. We hold the same foundation or the same core values. If we didn't, we wouldn't be able to disagree. We wouldn't even communicate with each other, but we do. And on the most important values in some ways. And so we've been talking about some basic concepts of how societies function. We spent a long time on that, on individualism and collectivism, as some people refer to it, communitarianism, as I'm referring to it on purpose, for reasons that we've talked about in the first couple of episodes. And so what I want to do today is pick up on this fact that we were closing with last time, that historically and biblically and theologically, there is space for us to know our moral condition, both as individuals and as being inextricably bound up in the moral condition of our culture. And that's regardless of whether we're doing it consciously or not. This is not about us making choices about what we're going to prioritize, but simply the way that we see the world. And the space for that historically and theologically, we talked about in detail with a prayer of Daniel in Daniel 9 last time at the end of the discussion in that episode. But there's more than that. It's not like just let's eisegete some text and make it mean what we want it to mean. You know, biblically, Ezra offers the same kind of prayer. Nehemiah is leading his people in the same kind of corporate repentance. And even just looking at the stories of the Old Testament, especially, it becomes obvious, Israel's soldiers dying. I mean, we're talking about scores of people dying because one man in the congregation in Israel snuck in and stole that gold that was in Jericho that he wasn't supposed to take, Achan, his sin. Israel, even not even in terms of punishment, but just Israel standing as a congregation, as a body, as a corporation together, accepting the covenant together between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, when it's being pronounced by Joshua, the whole idea of the whole body of Israel acting together to receive the covenant, all of that gives us space to understand this historically. But moving forward from that, acknowledging that when we went through the Enlightenment, we adopted this way of seeing ourselves as individuals independent of our community, acting independently, and that becoming the highest priority. A rights-based society depends on that understanding of ourselves as individuals who are protected from the interest of the community, from the interest of the covenant, we would have said in the Old Testament. It depends on that, and no one expresses that more forcefully than Freud. In fact, he's the one who gives form to the way we begin to see ourselves as individuals with such clarity. He gives form to it with such clarity that to this day, we rely on that understanding of ourselves. I know we don't think of our psychological disciplines in a Freudian sense anymore. I know we've left behind some of the basics of how he would do psychotherapy, but not the cultural premise, not his way of articulating what makes an individual psyche so important. And Freud is eminently individualistic. I mean, everything he does, he is the patriarch of inherently individualistic psychotherapy. The idea that what we need is people who are psychologically healthy. That's what makes for a healthy society in a Freudian understanding and in our understanding of the world around us. And if you don't think that's where we live, you're just not paying attention to where our culture is. We're not trying to help people who feel guilty cooperate with the community around them and conform. That's anathema in our society. The idea that you would say to someone who's feeling guilty, hey, just conform to your culture and everything will be okay. Nobody would think to do that now. Instead, we say, how can we help you come to peace with how you feel about yourself? Because you shouldn't have to conform to the expectations of your culture around you. And it doesn't, I'm not criticizing progressives. I'm describing the whole of our culture, from conservatives to progressives. We all embrace that ideology, whether we think we do or not. That's where we live, and Freud is the patriarch of that inherently individualistic psychotherapeutic view of who we are. Now, and again, I know that sounds like a bunch of $10 words, but just think about it. If you find someone who's having any kind of crisis, emotionally or otherwise, we don't say, hey, well, let's just figure out a way to make you fit in with everybody. How can we get you to conform? That's just not how we think about it. And so in Freudian thinking, the whole premise is that the individual begins in a state of natural opposition to the rest of society. It is the emergence of individualism and an explanation of what that would be. You are, as an individual in this Freudian sense, you are learning to be deprived from the things that you want as an individual in order to benefit from the things that society can give you as an individual. That's how Freud frames things. So you are eventually, in his view of the id and the ego and the superego and the way they work together in, you know, civilization's discontents, that's a book of his, eventually you are internalizing society's prohibitions and approbations for yourself so that you are somehow content. But it's not because you, in a healthy way, not because you just do everything the community wants. It's because you've internalized the expectations of the community. And now, as an individual, you can be fulfilled in that society. Why am I spending time on Freud? Because Freud, again, to say it, is the person who gives form to a different way we understand ourselves by the end of the 19th century, to the way we understand ourselves as individuals. And all of this is coming back to economics and racism and the Soji issues and abortion in just a moment. But if we grasp the depth of the distinction in our way of thinking of ourselves as individuals from culture's previous way of seeing themselves as communitarian, as depending entirely on the society for their identity, for their belonging, then we can grasp where some of these conflicts are coming from in just a moment. What's most ironic about Freud, and the reason I'm bringing him up, is because despite the fact that he is the king, the patriarch of this individualism in terms of us comprehending how we can defend that stance of things, even he himself is bound to a communitarian self. He cannot escape it. He doesn't even realize that he is depending even on his own sense of himself as part of this community of Western civilization. He doesn't even realize it. So that in The Future of an Illusion, for instance, another book of his, Future of an Illusion, it's about religion. You can see how antithetical to religion Freud is by the title of that book. In The Illusion, religion is the illusion, and it should be undone. We should see through it and become more scientific in our thinking. He sees religion in that book as imposing false communitarian values, but he doesn't replace them with just radical individualism, radical creative individualism, or existentialism. It's not that. He replaces it with science. He sees the answer as science. We should be embracing the values of science. We should move forward in our community with the values of science. And even in the beginning of the 20th century, it wasn't part of our natural way of thinking to simply dismiss the values of communitarianism. But even for a person as radically committed to individualism as Freud, there is no escaping the fact that we are all, everywhere, in every society, both, and this is in reality, not in our recognition of it, not in the way we express our values, but in the reality of it. We are all, always, both individuals and part of a community. It's inherent. We desire our rights and our freedoms, but we also desire belonging. And with belonging come obligations. You know, the holidays are upon us now. We've just gotten through Thanksgiving and headed toward Christmas. And the joy of belonging to a family comes with the obligations of sitting down at the table with them and putting up with the conversations that some of us love and some of us might not. That's just the nature of being part of a group, part of and finding part of our identity in belonging. So then, after understanding that we're always going to have both of these things present in us, but we incline ourselves only to express the values of individualism, then we can return to the issues and understand what we're really looking at. That we have, as I've said before, an easy appreciation for personal liberties, choosing the individual over society, but we always also have this hidden or sometimes convoluted agenda to defend the claims of society against the individual. But we don't say that very often, not openly, because it doesn't win the argument for us. So we keep it submerged instead. And we need to bring that to the surface so that we can discuss it openly. What's ironic is that liberals and libertarians, progressives and conservatives, base their arguments on both of these ideas and how they balance with each other, and they end up just choosing the same kinds of positions, but on opposite issues. I'm not saying that the issues don't have hard values associated with them, or that we wouldn't come down with the same conclusion as a conservative, for instance. But I am saying we could have a much more reasonable discussion with each other if both of us recognize that we actually have at the core the same values that we're espousing and then applying to different issues in different ways. So as we wander back and forth freely between these profound claims of liberty and more cryptic claims of civil and social authority, then we can make some progress on how we actually live together as a society. So this is what we need to do. And so expressing our foundational moral arguments on freedom and respect and for individual liberties and rights on all of these issues and seeing how those balance with our obligations, then I think it's worth seeing how that goes on the conservative side and on the progressive side. So first, let's look at it from the conservative side. And I don't mean by that that every conservative sees it this way. Obviously, people term themselves conservatives. Others categorize people, pigeonhole them into categories that we may or may not agree with. But let's look at it from what would generally be considered the conservative side in terms of those four issues: economics, racial issues, sexuality and gender, and then the more complicated one, as I'll explain in a moment, abortion. Obviously, you know, in the limited amount of time we have, we can't actually resolve these issues or even delve deeply into them today. We don't need to. We just need to look at all four of those issues and see how the conservative side in general makes their case, how the progressives on their side make their case in order to see where the common ground is, not where they agree on the issues, but where they agree on how they're founding, how they're grounding, and then how they're building their issues from that. And so we'll start on the conservative side to talk about how we look at, first, economics. So a lot of individualists, people who are prioritizing individualism above everything else, will argue for, obviously, laissez-faire economics. Hands off, government, leave us alone kind of stuff. The markets should be free, unrestrained. It's caveat emptor, let the buyer beware. They can defend themselves. We don't need a nanny state. We're for decentralization and for deregulation and get the government out of our business. It sort of follows the teachings of Friedrich Hayek, you know, the road to serfdom guy, and Milton Friedman, the hugely influential economist from the mid-20th century. And, you know, what's being embraced in that kind of individualism is the normal perspective, or at least the predominant perspective, of those who would consider themselves conservatives on the economy. It's sort of the traditional conservative view of the economy. Let's not let the government get involved in it. That's the whole point. Protect people who want to participate in the economy, not punish them or regulate them to death. So the object on the opposite side is to reject the imposition of very many community obligations with that economic freedom. And so there should be no nanny state. There should be no welfare state. Now, that doesn't mean no one cares for anyone or anything like that. And again, I'm not caricaturing it, but we are characterizing it in the simplest terms to say a conservative economic approach has been identified with an individualistic economic approach, one that prioritizes rights over obligations. Now, that's not super complicated. It's pretty traditional. On racial issues, it's very similar. There is an individualist argument about racism that says, well, issues of race are matters of personal responsibility. If someone, an individualist would argue, and most of the time, these are people who would identify themselves as conservatives. They would argue, look, you have opportunity in this economy. Pick yourself up, and this is exaggerated, it's hyperbole, but pick yourself up by your own bootstraps. Apply yourself as some others have, and you'll be able to have the same success they have. And stop blaming the system. And so there is a rejection in this individualistic and normally conservative approach to dealing with race issues. There is a rejection of things like affirmative action or, you know, 50 years ago, busing, enforced desegregation, things like that. Systemic analyses, where you look at the whole system and try to see what's wrong, would be generally rejected by an individualist because you say, look, it's not about the community. It's not about the society. It's about the individual and what you want to do. And so climb the steps, Rocky. Go win the battle. You know, you can do it yourself. That kind of focus on individualism is very closely identified with a conservative way, the way most people would categorize a conservative way of looking at race issues. On sexuality and gender, it suddenly turns the opposite direction. I'll get to abortion last because it's the most complicated. But on sexuality and gender issues, on the conservative side generally, it immediately turns in the opposite direction. Because the idea in conservative circles generally, and again, this is not true for everyone who would call themselves a conservative, but the concern generally is that traditional marriage should be defended. Traditional marriage with all of those obligations that go with the society. It is marriage, by definition, is actually historically, traditionally, is society's sanctioning, blessing of a relationship. That's why you have to go to the court and get a license. It's why you need a clergy member to perform the ceremony. I've mentioned this before. Why you have to go and get a divorce if the marriage is going to end. You can't just say to each other, hey, we're tired of each other. We're going to go our separate ways. You have to go get legal permission not to be married anymore because it's a social obligation. Traditional marriage, which is largely embraced by people who would call themselves conservatives, is actually a communitarian obligation. Not an individualist obligation. In fact, in terms of rights, we wouldn't even talk about marriage, except in the very negative sense that someone shouldn't keep you from getting married. But more about that when we get to the progressives. The point here is that for a traditionalist and a person who's a traditionalist would normally be considered a conservative, it's not about individualism. It is about accepting the norms of society. yielding to the restraints of the community. And so there's a rejection of that idea that love is love, you know, the love equals love symbol, that one person's love, the individualist approach, one person's love deserves the same protections as another person's love. That's rejected in the traditionalist approach to these things, which tells you that even among conservatives who would normally rise up and say, look, we are all about rights and liberty and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence, and, you know, it's all about the individual. Even those who would consider themselves conservative as focusing on individualism, when it comes to some issues, are actually quite committed to a communitarian obligation, traditional marriage as a social obligation. The last example, this is the complicated one, abortion. And we'll talk about it on both sides again in a moment. But from the conservative side, there is a rejection of women's rights about reproduction. Not that people would ever stand up and say, I reject women's reproductive rights. You know, nobody's saying that. But the idea that abortion should be considered a right is rejected, which it's considered a right by the women who favor abortion remaining legal, obviously. And so I think most people who would consider themselves conservatives on the issue of the sanctity of life, as I would prefer to say it, on the right to life, as other people say it, on the issue of abortion, as some people are going to characterize it, are the people who are saying, no, let's not focus on women's rights. But they're also not simply saying, let's focus on the community's values. That's not exactly the argument that would come from someone who would consider themselves a conservative. There is a more individualistic argument in Western society about abortion. That is, if you're in China and you have a one-child policy for a while, that's a communitarian argument. It's bad for our culture if you're having too many babies and so on. Now, that's changed, obviously, and they've changed that policy. It's catastrophic in its long-term consequences, but they didn't think through that, which is why decentralization is good and centralization is sometimes bad. That's the conservative me slipping out during this discussion parenthetically. Anyway, when you put all of that aside, those are communitarian, but that's not the argument here. There's actually an argument where we're saying, I'm pro-life, so on the conservative side of this issue, just being pro-life, the conservatives would normally actually favor infants' rights. An infant in the womb should be protected as an adult outside of the womb, meaning we're making the argument based on the value of each individual person, the rights of the individual. And that's why I focus on sanctity of life and the image of God and all of those things that matter to me. And that's why other groups focus on the right to life. And they have to have the argument then about personhood for the baby in the womb and all that kind of stuff, which gets philosophically complicated and we're not going to do right now, even though you can tell I want to. The point is that we're actually arguing in a complex way, both for and against individualism, without considering communitarianism at all. Very few people, because a lot of people who are opposed to abortion being legal also are Protestants, and they are okay with contraceptives. So you almost never hear the argument, you should have all the babies you can, and you can't have any restraint on it, and you're robbing our society of children if you have abortions. There are some arguments made that way, but most are not those communitarian arguments. Most are about protecting the individual life that's in the womb. They are individualistic arguments. In the same way that we are pushing against, conservatives are pushing against, those same individualistic arguments when they're applied to the mother instead of to the baby. Because you can see that what you would have to embrace as a mother is a communitarian obligation. You have an obligation to a family member. You have an obligation to our society to protect the life of the child that's inside of you. So that's a different issue altogether. This one is us saying, look, this is an individual child. It should be protected by the law, and you have no right to violate that. So the idea that we're arguing sort of individualism on both sides of that issue shows up just on what I would call the conservative side of approaching it. So now let's take those four issues, economics, racial issues, sexuality, and gender, and then the one that I mentioned at the end, the complicated one, abortion, and put them on the other side of the equation, on the progressive side. And I'm choosing progressive because it's not always politically accurate to describe someone as Republican or Democrat. And, you know, some people, libertarians, fall on one side or the other of that spectrum. And again, the categories can get mixed up. But by progressives, you know, I mean people who are advocating in a progressive direction for the culture in general or for the individuals who are in the culture. So how do they look at economics? Well, you know, some, and again, using the term progressive is broad and generic, but just looking at it broadly, someone is thinking of communitarian obligations if they are arguing in economics for a centralized and regulated economy so that some central committee is going to meet and they're going to decide how many jobs we need to have and whether the job sector should be focused on carbon emissions or on, you know, high-tech progress for the future or on education or on whatever. If you centralize the control of an economy, you are saying we need someone to have the perspective of the community's interest at heart, not just profit, not just how they're going to make money. Individualism says, well, actually, and this is just following Adam Smith, right? So actually, if a person's pursuing profit, and this is the John Galt kind of approach, you know what I'm talking about, if you're familiar with Atlas Shrugged, Ayn Rand and all of that, you know, the idea is, hey, if you're focused on profit, you're benefiting the economy more than anybody else can. This is the opposite view of that. And so a person who's focused on communitarian obligations would say, yeah, we need more regulations. We need more protection of the little guy, as people used to say in politics 50 years ago. And they get these ideas from economists like John Maynard Keynes on the soft side of it, all the way up to Karl Marx, you know, with complete control of the economy. But the one thing that they would reject, and by the way, if you want to really understand economics, you need to take it from an economist. You need to learn it from somebody who's done political economy or economics in general, like Brandon Seitzler at Criswell College in our PPE program. Great program. Does that sound like an advertisement? Yes, it is. Anyway, the point is that a person who's looking at it from that communitarian side and the obligations that we have would never favor unfettered capitalism. Just go make your profit, and the more prosperous you can be, well, the higher all the other boats will float too. That's just not the approach you would take from a communitarian side. You would say, rather, how do we protect the most vulnerable in the economy? What do we do to take care of those people who are not able to lift themselves up by their own bootstraps and so on? So on economics, there really is an opposition where there's a focus on individualism from what's normally referred to as the conservative side, and then a focus on communitarian obligations from what's normally considered a more progressive side of things. But even that, if you take the other issues into account, gives you a common ground. I'll come back to that in a moment to explain what I mean by it. Let's take racial issues from the progressive perspective for a moment. So again, not that there is a single progressive perspective, but normally a person who's focused on communitarian obligations is the one who's going to acknowledge systemic injustices. That's the person who's going to say, there's something wrong with our criminal justice system. There is something wrong with our society because we've created structural extensions of slavery. Police forces, some would say, in the criminal justice system, in this progressive, more communitarian way of seeing it, which are, well, police forces were formed up for the sake of chasing down runaway slaves and bringing them back. And the structural heritage of that comes all the way down to this day. Some people would say that on the progressive. Those are communitarian perspectives on how injustices take place in the society. It's not looking at the actions of an individual. It's looking at the actions of the society as a whole, the trajectory of the society as a whole, and saying what should happen as a result of that. So, for instance, if an individualist were to look at a particular criminal act, they wouldn't say, oh, well, he's economically deprived, so it makes sense that he would have committed this crime. But a progressive might. They might not say, oh, well, it's okay that they committed this crime because of this. But they might say, hey, the solution here is not just to throw more people in jail. The solution here is going to be for us to change the way our economy works. To change the way the economy works means to control the way the economy works, and it means to become more public, more communitarian in our way of describing our obligations to each other. So on racial issues, on the progressive side, you do end up with a more communitarian perspective about things normally. In the same way that they would reject on a progressive side, and certainly on a communitarian side, but most often on a progressive side as well, reject the idea that individual hard work is just going to solve the problem. That's just not where it comes from. And by the way, that division of progressives and conservatives along those lines, both on economics and racial issues, is often tied in with that term, the Judeo-Christian work ethic. And I'm not demeaning the Judeo-Christian work ethic as a way of understanding the world around us, but very often that term, the Judeo-Christian work ethic, has been associated with that particular political stance on those particular issues. And so just recognizing that means saying, oh, so this is a promotion of individualism. This is a promotion of collectivism or communitarian perspectives or values, or how we find our identity in public belonging and obligation rather than in just rights. But then the weird magic happens and we get to sexuality and gender. And just as I mentioned, when we were on sexuality and gender under the conservative, so to speak, side of things, suddenly we were communitarian. You know, we're like, oh, you know, you need to care about the common interests of values and so on. Well, it's just exactly the opposite on the, quote, progressive. I'm doing air quotes and you can't see them. Progressive side, sexuality and sexual orientation and identity in this more progressive look at things is individualistic. They're no one's business but of the subject in question. No one else should have say in what pronouns are going to be used about me, in what my sexual orientation or interests are, or in the shape of my marriage, or even the size, ultimately, of my marriage, how many people are involved in it. Ultimately, I mean, that's part of the picture. Every individual can make their choices about how they want to participate. No one should be forced. But as long as no one else is being forced, that's rights language. You understand it's rights language when you say, well, as long as both people are participating freely and no one's being forced, all you mean by that is each individual is making their own choice to participate so they can do whatever they want. That approach to things is not communitarian at all. It is focused entirely on individualism. I'm not saying it's the argument everyone makes, but a lot of people on the progressive side make the argument from that perspective, and lo and behold, it's arguing from the same grounding that conservatives, so to speak, were using when they talked about race issues or were using when they talked about economics issues. And yet we've chosen to apply more individualistic arguments when it has suited the purpose that we believed in, which I'm not saying is necessarily wrong. I'm not saying one side or the other is not right. I am saying that there's common ground between the two. I mean, if I can argue from a foundation of individualism for one thing, then I should be able to grasp how another person is arguing from a foundation of individualism for a completely different thing, one that I may reject. But I should be able to say, oh, I can see why you're saying that. I can understand where you're coming from. And then I should be able to have a more meaningful conversation that I would otherwise. We'll come back to that in a moment and why that is. But it all, you know, it also means if on this sexuality and gender side, on the progressive side of evaluating things, it also means that where there are those liberties and, you know, how you define the pronouns and sexual orientation, marriage, and all that kind of stuff I was talking about a moment ago, on this other side, it also means there is a little communitarian underpinning to what's going on. And that communitarian underpinning for the SOGI sort of movement, the sexual orientation, gender identity movement, the LGBTQ plus movement in some other senses also, again, it's not universal. People are categorized in different ways, is that it's not just individualistic because society needs to approve of it. That is, it's not, so I get why there's such a push for public accommodations to be made for people who might be excluded from the economy otherwise, even on things involving creativity and so on. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying I get the argument. You know what I'm talking about, the cake bakers for marriages and stuff like that. I'm not saying I agree with forcing a person to bake a cake and decorate it. I'm just saying I understand the argument. Because this is a public service being offered. And if we're offering a public service and we say, no, you're black, you can't come in here and get this service, we would understand why that's wrong. And it makes sense that somebody would make a similar argument about things regarding sexual orientation. I'm not saying they're right. I'm saying it makes sense to make the argument. You understand? It means there is a ground for having a discussion about it. And at that point, we might actually be able to resolve something. But the point here is, it's not just about public accommodations, which really do just come down to individualism and the rights of the individual to walk into a store and buy anything they want to buy just like anybody else can buy it. That's individualism. That's not what this is about. But there is also, because there is also this need for explicit approval of the relationship itself. We want to be able to walk into the courthouse and get a license for a same-sex marriage. We want to be able to get the approval of our community. And in that sense, we've gone back to acknowledging that there's still something important about the community obligations that we have, even when we're individualists. Do you see how I'm saying? Not that somebody's self-contradictory and they're just undermining their own argument, but instead saying, lo and behold, we actually share a lot of ground on these issues around both communitarian and individual communitarian obligations and individual rights. I'll put it that way. And on abortion, the most complicated one out of the four that we've talked about. And again, it's most complicated because we're embracing individualism on both sides as we're pushing against both sides. So on the abortion issue, obviously a more progressive or an advocate for abortion rights is going to say yes to women's rights. It's all about reproductive rights and the freedom of the woman. But that is a promotion of individualism for that woman. And when a person that's on the more progressive side says no to infant rights, well, you can understand why that response is couched in rejecting the personhood of the infant. So you want to say, look, we are protecting individuals' rights. This is just not an individual yet. And so they don't qualify. The argument that's being made makes more sense if you recognize that we're trying to avoid simply saying you have a communitarian obligation. We're trying to embrace the value most of us espouse more highly than any other, which is individual rights, the freedoms of individuals. Give me freedom or give me death kind of language. All of that is saying the individual is the thing that matters. So when a pro-life person is saying you have to protect the person, that you have to protect the baby in the womb, then they want to make the case that that baby has a right to live, that it's already a person, and that you should see that and protect that life. And when a person on the other side is saying, no, the woman's right to have an abortion is what matters here, then they want to say, and there is no other right in conflict with it. This is the right that has to be preserved because we're focusing on individualism. And so now, as we're looking at these different issues, we can go back and take them one at a time, and I won't take time to do it now in detail, but we could go back one at a time and look at these in pretty great detail to see where the common ground actually lies on all four issues. I mean, if you're looking at it in economics and racial issues, sexuality and gender, and on abortion, let's just take economics and then sexuality and gender, like I did a moment ago. And just say that if you're a conservative, a person who considers yourself a conservative, and you're focused on the individualism, the individualist rights of people in economics, like I was describing a moment ago, and then you're talking to somebody about sexuality and gender issues, and they're focused on the individual rights of people who have a different perspective on sexuality and gender than you do, then instead of immediately jumping down their throat and saying, our whole society's going to fall apart if you do this, why not start the conversation with, so you believe in the individual rights of people regarding their sexuality and gender in the same way I believe in the individual rights of people regarding economics. They may even agree with you on economics. There are a lot of people who agree on both of those issues being focused on individual rights. And I'm thinking in particular of some log cabin Republicans that I know who are in that camp and who would say, no, it's all about the libertarian side of things. But then there is always a communitarian obligation that will come up or a recognition that will come up. And if nothing else on economics, let's just take an innocuous one here so I don't have to go down the rabbit hole and stay there for too long. But on economics, which is fairly easy to talk about, it's less inflammatory sometimes. On economics, just acknowledging that taxes can be collected without being necessarily theft is to acknowledge that we do have a communitarian obligation. Just to provide for the common defense is enough to admit that we have a collective or communitarian obligation with our money that even goes beyond the freedoms that we have with capitalism. I made this money. You don't have a right to take it and buy a gun and hire a soldier and protect me from some other country destroying us and taking my business that I made the money with. That's nonsensical. It's self-contradictory. So it acknowledges right off the bat that there's ground for us to be able to have this discussion more meaningfully than in the absolute terms. You either absolutely believe in individualism or you absolutely believe in violating every right of every individual in the culture and so on. We can do better than that in the conversation if we understand these groundings that underlie what's going on with it. Okay, so with all that said, then we need to take these three episodes and just give a very brief wrap-up. And the first thing I want to say is to repeat how we ended the second episode by saying we have to remember that there is hope. I'm not simply saying, well, we'll never be able to solve these problems. I don't know the solution to the problems, but I know the solution is going to come from people coming together to find solutions. It's not going to come by one half of the country destroying or eliminating the other half of the country. That's just not, first of all, it's not going to happen. It's not going to succeed. And it's not the right approach to take to things. And so when I said before, we know that we're coming to blows, we should recognize the common ground on which we have come to those disagreements. And I want us to start recognizing those. And some other topics will emerge from this. We will discuss them later, and there'll be whole episodes by themselves talking about corporate guilt and pride in American culture as a whole. We have a hard time acknowledging that, and we should talk about it. Talking about baptism. I mentioned it before. Adult baptism, infant baptism, and sprinkling, and how different denominations understand each other, and what the history is that brought all that to pass, and how churches are organized, and is it run by an elder or by a bishop, or is it congregationally run? And all of those kinds of things are interesting and would be worth talking about. But for today, let me just lay down three points of footing for the future. And that those points of footing are based on us having come to an understanding that we are on the same field, that we are based in a country that's individualistic and yet has this underlying recognition of community obligations that we share. Number one, that footing promotes humility. And that's simply to realize that the conservative reasoning on economics is the same as progressive reasoning on sexuality and gender. Just recognizing that can help promote some humility and some recognition that I am not the end-all and be-all of truth in our society, and that it's okay for me to hear someone else's argument and actually possibly, potentially, not likely, but maybe learn something from them in the process. Secondly, that footing creates avenues for understanding where the barriers are. If you don't know where the barriers are, you can never get them down. But if you know where the barriers are, so why, for instance, abortion advocates reject the personhood of babies? Why pro-life advocates avoid any consideration of reproductive issues as rights? And acknowledging that women are losing some freedom if abortion is illegal, things like that are the barriers that keep us from having reasonable conversations with each other. Recognizing where the barrier is can cause some reasonable people to sit down in a room together and start saying, how do we move forward from here to a different place? Because in this place, it's not good enough. We are not protecting the children or the women in this scenario right now. Everybody's under threat. And then finally, in this footing for the future, it creates a connection with others as human beings, not just enemies or monsters. That's worth repeating one more time, because this is the picture of our society we've created, where it's us against those enemies, those monsters over there that we're comfortable with sliding in every way. This footing where we recognize that we're on the same field together creates a connection with others as humans, not just enemies or monsters. May we share this field with each other as we go forward.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycremer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.